I am delighted to welcome back to Caravan to Midnight Mr. Larry Kelly, back from episode 163. As you may know, he is the author of Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. There's volume one. There's also now a volume two. If his name is new to you, let me bring you up to speed quickly. His life was utterly changed by the events of 9/11. On the day after those attacks, on his way to work, he was struck by the sudden realization that World War III had commenced. Like most Americans, he desperately wanted to find out who are these people who attacked us, and what could ordinary citizens do to join the battle? How can those plotting to kill us off in future attacks be defeated? Well, he's written scores of columns on the dangers of Western complacency, and I'm pretty sure we're all well acquainted with that now. In his tenure as a political commentary writer, he's made a significant impact. His feature articles have appeared in the Piedmont Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, Human Events, Town Hall Magazine. Two of his articles were featured on the cover of Town Hall Magazine. He wrote an op-ed, or opposing editorial, which appeared in the liberal San Francisco Chronicle a month before Obama was inaugurated, entitled, A Second New Deal is a Recipe for Disaster. 2.5 years later, on August 6, 2011, the Chronicle ran the front page headline, S&P downgrades U.S. credit rating. The result of 10 years of research, his book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, contains the answers the above questions he asked in the wake of 9/11. His book's already received critical praise as a saga, which begins on the plain of Marathon in 490 BC, and whose main character is Western civilization. He's currently a marketing consultant to technology companies, a freelance writer, and one who'd whimsically be self-described as a former adventurer, not to mention an early developer of the modern skateboard. In the late 70s, he attended the University of California at Santa Barbara, earned a B.A. in English Literature. In between readings of Milton, Keats, Wordsworth, and Jack Kerouac, he took up surfing and adopted the resonant neo-beat generation surfing subculture of Isla Vista, that off-campus youth ghetto overlooking the Pacific. Kelly had climbed the five tallest peaks in the lower 48 states, including the Grand Tetons. What a guy. I'll tell you what, you've lived a life that a lot of people would be downright envious of. Larry, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, John. It's good to hear your voice again.
You know, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, Volume 1, The Fall of the Greek Polis, 323 BC, The Fall of Carthage, 146, The Fall of Rome, AD 476, The Fall of the Christian Middle East, AD 632 through 732, the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1918, the modern Islamic threat and our 44th president, reigniting American resolve to defeat those plotting our destruction and empowering allies in our way for survival. That was a really, really dynamic way to start. But now you have volume two, The Way Forward, Can a Bankrupt America Survive the Current Islamic Threat? Published essays, Understanding We Are Losing the War and Losing the Country. To win any war is to know thy enemy. Winning the war with hard power and smarter power. The desperate need for a reformation of Islam. And a winning agenda, the list. That's what's in volume two. So I think that's enough exposition. I've just about taken up half the program just with the exposition. So let's talk about this stuff. This is, what do you make of Donald Trump in contrast to Mr. Obama, who's 2 miles away, holed up with Valerie Jarrett in his 8,000-plus square foot residence?
Yeah, well, I tell people that, you know, I wasn't really on board on the Trump bandwagon early, but about 2 weeks before the election, I said to myself, this is actually an easy decision, John, because on the one hand, yes, we do have a flawed candidate. Some people would say very flawed candidate. This 2 weeks before the election. And on the other hand, we have an admitted felon. So that was an easy choice for me. I tell people who are adamant Trump haters that who voted for Hillary, I'll get people that will admit that they have done that because Trump is, in their view, such a bad actor. And I tell them, I say, well, how do you expect the rule of law to pertain in this country if we had elected a woman who is an admitted felon who compromised national security for money, for big money? And she admitted so. And then we had to watch the spectacle of Comey, you know, stand up there and say no reasonable prosecutor would, you know, indict her. And I, to which I tell my friends that hate Trump, if she had been a Republican, she'd already be in jail.
Well, that's for sure.
So it goes somewhat to my topic. My topic is, as you intimated earlier, it's a far-ranging topic, but I do think that would threaten the rule of law. If you don't have a rule of law, then you know, we've gone way down the road to becoming a banana republic where, you know, the strong man in power criminalizes the political opposition. And Jefferson and our founders, you know, really warned us about that you know, too much power centralized into what I see now as kind of a lawless movement. On the left does definitely threaten our republic, and some people might even argue, John, that we are already a post-constitutional republic.
Well, it kind of looks that way. I've said this now. This will be the third time I've said this in less than 3 days, fewer than 3 days, and that is, it's supposed to be equal protection under the law.
Yes,
I think the operative word now is law. But it's not supposed to be selective prosecution on a case-by-case basis under the so-called mm-hmm. law. And
yes.
I'm a little concerned about that. There was a thing about where Mr. Trump had tweeted out a bunch of stuff regarding Jim Comey, the FBI director. Don't forget, when Jim mm-hmm. Comey came out, he saved Hillary Clinton. People don't realize that. He saved her life. And that's a fact. This is a Lockheed Martin guy. And then he goes, FBI director, and, oh, it's all a big deal. You know, this is terrible, this stuff on the email server. Then it's no big deal. Then right before the election, it's a big deal again. Then it goes away again. I mean, what kind of conduct is this anyway? He had that look.
It's alarming.
Yes, I'll say.
I know. It really is. So the thing that is remarkable to me about Trump, I mean, there are lots of things that I think are unusual and new and maybe unique to the presidency. But think about this, John. I'd like to have your audience consider this. Supposedly, he operates 400 companies. I guess every property is its own company, but still, how does one do that? And think about all of the filings that he's had to do, all of the paperwork that's had to have been submitted under his signature. It's amazing that he doesn't, that they don't have, you know, a way to go after him criminally. And if they had it, we'd probably have seen it by now, John, I would think. So that's remarkable right there, that somehow they're trying to destroy him or his opposition, trying to criminalize, you know, the Trump presidency. And they haven't been able to do it yet. With all of that he has had, all the records that have to be public that can be found about his business dealings, they haven't come up with it yet. That's remarkable to me.
Yeah, that's putting it kind of mildly. It is remarkable. Oh, boy. So now, what's your opinion, or what has your analysis shown of this thing in Syria? Do you want to touch that for a minute, this gas attack
sure.
in Syria? Now
mm-hmm.
we're seeing a picture mm-hmm. Of the general who supposedly was flying the plane that dropped the gas canisters, and this is the first time he's done it, and oh, look, a car bomb went off. A bomb went off underneath his car, and he's dead now. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, but I'm thinking this looks a little bit too convenient. This looks like a staged thing. I'm not sure if it is, but I can't imagine why Bashar al-Assad would do such a thing, knowing that the entire world would be pointing the finger at him and, you know, baring their teeth and everything else. You used poison gas against your own people, okay, that time-worn phrase, against his own people. Allah Saddam Hussein, you know, and all of that. It appears that Saddam Hussein really did do that. But I'm not so sure about Assad with the Russians and the Americans both hovering around there. This doesn't look right to me. Does this look like it's even possible, possibly true?
John, it's the second time. Assad gassed his people 2 years ago also. And Obama said that was the red line. Remember, and that then he went over the red line. I can't remember the sequence, whether he said that was the red line or if he used them, that it would go. But nevertheless, this is the second time in 2 years, and with large casualties. In the first book, I countered the old shop-worn belief that there were no WMDs in Iraq. Saddam was saying, and therefore Bush was also a criminal. Bush lied, people died, right? In my book, I show that there were all three programs. There were biologic, chemical, and nuclear weapons programs. We found the programs. We didn't find the ordnance. Well, it was a year buildup to that, to the invasion of Iraq by George Bush the younger. And they were able to either bury them or get them out of the country. And it was probably a little of both. And so the fact that Syria has chemical weapons, it doesn't prove that those were left over. Those were ordnance that got sent to him when Saddam Hussein wanted to get them out of the country. But it certainly proves, to my way of thinking anyway, that he bamboozled the Obama administration. And so did Putin, saying, yes, we'll get rid of them all. We'll destroy them, get them all out of the country. And then, of course, they didn't get them all out or continue to make them and continue to make them under the watchful gaze of the Russians. I guess they were able to read our former president well enough to know that he would go around the world bragging that he had gotten all the chemical weapons out, when in fact they kept some and maybe kept making them. So I get your point. Is that what I think you're asking me is, was this a ruse? Did they really want Trump to attack? And I'm not really sure. I think that's still playing out, John. I know that there's one thought about that. But until that more evidence comes out about whether this was some grand ruse or not, I'm going to stay with the assumption that they just felt that there wouldn't be any repercussions and it would be just an easy way to get rid of a lot of people. The reports also indicate that the reason that they blew up a hospital was because they that was the main hospital in the town where they were using the gas, and it meant that the people who had that were showing symptoms of being gassed could be completely destroyed. Therefore, they blew up this hospital. So we're looking at, you know, in the face of real evil here is what I think. And until there's a grand conspiracy that will eventually come out, if that's the case, and I'm pretty sure it would come out. I'm just going to stay with the fact that this is, you know, Syria and Russia are part of what I'm calling the new axis of evil.
Now, oh boy, with all of the stuff that's come out about Qatar and Saudi Arabia providing financial and logistic support to, they call it ISIL, and that whole Benghazi thing and everything else, it looks like people were dealing from, what's that expression, dealing seconds, where you don't deal the next card on top of the deck, the very top card on the deck, you deal the ones underneath. So, I mean, that's really what this looks like to me. So, but I'm wondering, you know, truck attack here, truck attack there, that thing that happened right by Parliament in London, then the another truck attack, and these are isolated things, but because we're so connected, you know, we can all experience the horror of these incidents as if, you know, we were right there. I mean, information about this stuff, we're not hearing about every car crash where there's fatality involved, but we are hearing about everything that looks like a terror attack. I'm thinking that these, whoever is running ISIS, and, you know, we've seen those films, and they don't look staged at all. They look real. Somebody got on their smartphone of Jihadi John standing there, and it looks like, you know, we're going to have an execution. I'm going to behead him with my pocket knife or whatever. And then they kind of call a break, and he tousles the so-called victim's hair, and I guess they broke for lunch at that point. Or had to change the shot or something. Then you find out about the $500 million, I think it was, that is that even possible for to some British company to produce fake terror films? And I'm thinking, okay, is this news real, or is this propaganda? Is this diversion? Is this disinformation? So, you know, you have to remain always the cynic. Right after 9/11, I stopped with the rah-rah, George Bush is the new Wyatt Earp, let's go get him. You know, I'm over that. I won't ever go back to that mentality. But I'm just wondering, regardless of who's running ISIS really, I'm thinking they're not going to stop. And I'm thinking that the next attack in this country is going to be on a near spectacular level. How do you see the ISIS threat? And if you want to, and I wish you would, tie in the bankrupt America being able to confront the Islamic threat. I mean, if one person, like this character that stole a bunch of guns and then made threats against Mr. Trump, if this guy can capture the news media's attention for days, then what would a half a dozen or a dozen incidents occurring in the same week, what would that do to the psychology of the... to the psyche of the American head and the response of the media and the response of law enforcement. I'm thinking it's just not that hard, if you've already got a skittish population, to really set some bad things in motion.
Yeah. Warren Buffett, who is very knowledgeable in regarding risk, he is a principal in a number of reinsurance companies, who of course take, you know, they buy risk from the insurance companies and their reinsurance. Therefore, because he is a principal in a number of those, he has, you know, kind of an authority in terms of the risk we're facing. And what he has said is that there will be a WMD terrorist event somewhere in the West. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So that's one thing I would say, is that Trump, I think, is correct that if you've got a rogue state like Syria or Iran or North Korea, and they start exhibiting the use of WMDs and chemical weapons and things like that, the risk to us is existential, and it must, you know, it must be dealt with. And I have a piece coming out early next week. It will be a feature-length piece. And its title is going to be, Is This the Next Cuban Missile Crisis? And what I'm referring to is North Korea.
Yeah.
But remember, North Korea is very, very closely allied with Iran. When they do a missile test in Pyongyang, there are Iranian scientists there witnessing, and then vice versa. When there's a big conclave in Tehran with nuclear scientists, and the North Koreans are there too. So concern is, and I interviewed a fellow for this piece on North Korea. His name is Peter Pry. He's also in the book. It's the second article that I've collaborated on. In the first book, I mean, the second book, but in my first published essay, is a piece on the electromagnetic pulse weapon that was also a cover story in Blaze magazine. And so that for your listeners who may not be completely up to speed on electromagnetic pulse, it is a weapon that if when detonated at apogee, they call it, about 300 to 400 miles over our atmosphere, it has the potential to take down our grid, to fry everything, where planes literally fall out of the sky, where your car doesn't even start. There's no banking system. We have done a terrifically bad job of getting ourselves ready for this threat because the grid is not yet hardened. It could have been if once the EMP weapon was known. It could also happen, by the way, through a solar flare. But nevertheless, we could have been doing this. We could have easily been hardening our grid for as little as probably $5 a year on your telephone bill. We, the American people, could have been hardening that grid over the last 8 to 10 years, and it hasn't happened. So that's the thing that I'm trying to warn people about, and I think now that's not going to happen in time. The ship has sailed on North Korea, and I watch it very, very closely, and I'm thinking that. And according to Peter Pry is executive director of the National Task Force for Homeland Security and is former CIA, but is considered the nuclear weapons expert. The country testifies before Congress. He's also on a task force on the EMP weapon. And he believes that that window is closing to where we're not going to be able to take all of the nuclear sites out. He thinks it can be done now with what we have in terms of missile defense, but it's not known.
Yeah,
it's not known. It's something that I'm bracing for, and I think it would. I don't really want to sound like a warmonger, but I'd remind your listeners that Hitler could have been dealt with. We lost 400,000 people, Americans, killed in World War II. Hitler could have been dealt with when he was far weaker. If the British and the French had dealt with him early, World War II could have been avoided. So I liken this situation with the axis of evil to a 1939 kind of a moment.
Yeah. We spoke with Peter Vincent Pry back on, I think, episode 660-something. And
good.
And
so you know him well.
Yeah, it was quite a good conversation. And he expressed his appreciation for the fact that he could actually talk for a while about these things and get into some subjects without having to stop for commercials and this and that. But as far back as July 26 of last year, Popular Science should remove Obama defense advisor Pete Singer from its editorial board. He has degraded the magazine, promoting a political and error-filled article by Kelsey Atherton. GOP platform vows to protect U.S. from a fantasy weapon, and EMP is an empty threat. That's from July 11, 2016. So, I mean, Peter tore him up in Newsmax. And, and I say this again, just in case somebody heard this. Normally, people just make a mistake and then sweep it under the rug. But I misassigned his work to somebody else, or rather somebody else's work to his, and that was Hugo Fugain. I just mixed them up for some reason because they struck me as equally brilliant. But Hugo Fugain is the one who deconstructed the whole Loretta Fuddy Cessna Caravan crash that supposedly claimed her life. And, I mean, by the time 7 hours went by, it was just ridiculously obvious that thing was staged. That whole thing was staged. I mean, different engines, different bent propellers, bent in different ways. It's not really easy to bend a propeller. Well, let's bend it this way and make it look more like the original one. So anyway, yeah, Peter Pry is he's on top of it. But you're saying, given where we are with North Korea, we're late to the party with our EMP shielding, our grid hardening.
That's correct. Yeah. In the piece that's in the book, that I also interview Pry and also a guy named Trent Franks, who is a congressman from Arizona who had a bill to get the grid hardened and thought that it could be passed maybe in towards the end of the Obama administration, but apparently it hasn't. It's just languished. And I asked him in the piece, I said, well, how long will it take? And he said, about 2 years. And I said, well, that would give the window of opportunity to whomever is planning to use it, an EMP weapon against us, namely North Korea and its consortium of allies, a 2 year window. And that's plenty of time. So as I said, I think the ship has sailed. Also in the book, I would like to point out to your listeners, I quote Obama as saying, this was towards the end of his second term, what he thought was the greatest threat to the United States. And he said it was global war. He thought it would be global warming. Well, we have evil players developing a weapon that can literally fry our grid. That was his response.
Oh boy. Well, yeah. You know, as recently as, wait a second, is this possible? Yes, it is. As recently as April 4th, I mean the April that we're in now, Peter Vincent Pry, Dr. Pry, wrote an article in, where did it go? Well, I guess it's published on familysecuritymatters.org. Yeah, it is. That Popular Mechanics, I just mentioned Popular Science a minute ago, right? Popular Mechanics publishes fake news on North Korean nuclear threat. And he, just so you know this, folks, popularmechanics.com published an article by Kyle Mizukami entitled, No, North Korea Can't Kill 90% of Americans. That was done on March 31st. Accusing former CIA Director R. James Woolsey and myself, meaning Dr. Pry, of grossly exaggerating the threat posed by electromagnetic pulse attack from North Korea in our recent article. So Peter's still all over it, the question is, I mean, and you're right in there, grid protecting SEPA enacted, but in time, probably not. So I guess we might as well just, I don't know about you, but I keep an old car around with mechanical points and just a coil and throw some copper screen over it and leave it parked with the battery disconnected, and just hope that at least I'll be able to get around without walking. But really, it's better to be prepared and nothing happen mm-hmm. than to not be prepared yeah. and everything happens. So
I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, it occurred to me this morning, just thinking about this and getting ready to write this piece. I've done the interview with Peter and the research, and I'm in the process of just writing it this week. If we were essentially, if our economy were destroyed, if a successful EMP attack occurred, and in which you're correct, your price is 90% of Americans will die. The only people that would survive that would be people that, have agrarian sources of food, right, and can sustain themselves. Everybody else would die from societal collapse. But if that were to happen, I would think probably 2/3 of Chinese would die, and maybe more of the Indians and so on. In other words, we are a $17 trillion economy. If that were suddenly just wiped out from the world economy, the world economy would crash unbelievably. So I have to believe, John, that China, the people running China, President Xi and his inner circle know this. They cannot they cannot countenance North Korea being able to do this without that happening. And so I'm wondering, or I'm hoping, that cooler heads can prevail, and that that we're dealing with some adults there who maybe they can get this guy to stop, or maybe they would, you know, essentially do nothing if we decide to take out the sites and use our missile defense to protect South Korea and our bases in Japan. Right? The wild card is this. This is also will be in the article. They have now, the North Koreans have two satellites orbiting the Earth and making passes over the United States. What we don't know, and Pry doesn't know this either, what we don't know is, are one or both of those equipped with an EMP device so that if the attack occurs, they can detonate it. If we decide to take out the sites, that's an unknown.
Yeah. Well, apparently a bunch of Chinese forces are mobilizing right now. Ground forces are mobilizing right now. It would not surprise me in the least if the Chinese president just said, you know what? I think we've had about enough of this. I think we better go in there and remove him. I mean, I'm seeing all kinds of stuff.
I hope that's the case.
Well, SEALs are training to shoot him, even.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. But it could be also that one of their biggest fears is that if the attacks take place, that, you know, hundreds of thousands of North Koreans will flood across the Yalu River, I guess is the border, into China, and they don't want to have to feed and house, you know, hundreds of thousands of North Koreans. But at the same time, they also fear, the Chinese fear, that if the Korean Peninsula were unified and is a functioning democracy right there, that's what they also fear. They don't want that right on their border, John. So maybe those Chinese troops are there poised to turn the Korean refugees back if our attacks take place. Don't know. I'm watching this. It's every day. You know, it's developments, and the tensions are rising really high. And I think Syria is, to me, to my way of thinking, I worry less about what's happening in Syria than I do North Korea.
Yeah, the only thing that worries me the most about Syria is what's written in Scripture about Damascus falling. You know, I'm sorry, but I have to pay attention to this. Like, the third of the sea shall be poisoned. It's like, oh, really? It's like, well, behold Japan and the Fukushima disaster. A third of the seas are being poisoned. I mean, huge, huge areas of that ocean have no life in them whatsoever. All sorts of weird, deformed sea creatures washing up on the entire west coast of the U.S., all the way up north, you know. So I don't know. Yeah, I understand why you would say that, but North Korea does seem to be the bigger problem. But, you know, as is so often the case, this, you know, problem A, it looks like the really bad one, but it's really problem B or maybe even C that we're going to see the flashpoint. So I don't know. I think the best thing to do is just watch all of it, because I don't know. Anything is liable to spiral out of control. But that's just the position that I take personally. You know, it's not the, I used to say this on the rock station. I said, the person next to you is not crazy. It's the one sitting next to him that's crazy. You know, so watch out.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's it. Well, while we're talking about a bankrupt America, how closely do you follow? I'm pretty sure that you wouldn't write something like that, even as a bullet point, if you weren't pretty well on top of the financial situation in this country. And it's been eerily quiet regarding financial matters for the last few weeks. What do you make of this?
Well, the $20 trillion that we're now in debt, Obama will go down in history as presiding over the doubling of the debt. The debt accumulated from George Washington's first year in office to the last year of George Bush's term, that amount of debt doubled under the last 8 years. And that's quite a record, wouldn't you think? It puts our former president in the record books.
Thanks, Barack.
To a largely negative degree. The interest rates are rising. So now the news is that the interest on the debt, if interest rates go to the levels that they should, we are going to be in a situation very soon where entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the interest on the debt are going to equal the total revenues that we collect in federal income taxes. Meaning that everything else that, you know, every pothole, every bridge, every bullet that goes into a soldier's rifle would have to be financed through further debt. So the thing that and this is one of the bullet points on the back of the book, Admiral Mike Mullen said, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this was in, I think, 2015, the most significant threat to our national security is our $19 trillion debt, because we are taxing the system, the banking system. Remember, banking is all built upon the trust of the depositors. You and I have to trust the fact that if we decide to go down to the bank and get our money out, they will be able to give it to us. But the point that people forget is that what happens if for some reason there is a panic, that people don't believe that the system is solvent for whatever the reason might be, and they all start lining up to get their money out. Well, they'll have to close the doors. We had runs on the banks in our parents' generations, not that far in the past when it's happened. So that's the admonition that I'm trying to point out here, is that entitlement spending has now run its course, and it's just our the next generation, the people that are going to be going to work. I have two young sons that are just starting out in their careers. They have no idea. They have no idea how much tax they're going to have to pay to try to keep this thing afloat. And I'm not really convinced that this amount of debt, where we are right now, is financeable. We're sort of in on the thin ice kind of thing.
Oh boy. All right then.
The good news is, I would say on the positive side, is that we are the largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
People will have to make accommodations for that if some kind of crisis occurs. Maybe that debt gets rescheduled. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows.
When you say that we're losing the war and we're losing the country, I'm thinking that we're fighting several different wars. Are you talking mm-hmm. about the broad overview of war, meaning all of those things that could potentially wreck our civilization, or mm-hmm. just one specific? Oh, you are, but not just one specific conflict.
No, it's not one specific conflict. We're fighting our own complacency.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, I think
because this is not sustainable. On the path we're on, it's not sustainable. And the thing that I would say about the Trump election, going back to your first question, that I had real worries that if Hillary got elected, you know, essentially someone who we know has no respect for the rule of law, at least in terms of her deportment and the people in power in her inner circle. So I thought that, I raised a glass with some friends after the election. I said, here's to the founders. Because remember now, she won the popular vote, but we have an electoral college that was conceived of, with the founding of the country, and that prevented us from putting, as I say, a known felon who compromised national security into the highest office in the land. So I see that as possibly even a little divine intervention.
Yeah. I really want. Let me ask you this. Have you cracked the code on what exactly hacking our election? The Russians hacked our election. What does that even mean? I ask again to the umpteenth time.
It's a bogus argument.
Okay, good.
It's basically what did Podesta do? whoever hacked into it, and it could have been not the Russians. It could have been somebody who purposely and got into the DNC email server, who then left a footprint, a false flag, if you will. Maybe it was the Russians, maybe it wasn't. WikiLeaks, who published it, maintains that it was not the Russians. When the Democrats are trying to delegitimize Trump, and by saying that the Russians hacked our elections, what they're attempting to say is that they changed votes. And there's no evidence that, Podesta looked like an idiot.
Completely.
His password was password, apparently. And he made a bunch of, remarks that came off making him look pretty stupid, really, unprofessional. I think there was some even racist stuff in there, but there's no evidence to suggest from polling and other places that votes were changed. There's no evidence that they were able to hack into the actual voting machines and change the tallies or anything. That's nothing that's suggested that. So it's starting to die. It's a slow death for the mainstream media to realize that this they just don't have the goods. They can't really, if they're really questioned, what do you mean by hacking the election? Like you just asked me, what do you mean by that? They're him and ha, but what they're trying to suggest is that votes were changed, and that just isn't true. The DNC looked really unprofessional. Apparently, the RNC was able to determine that there were attempts to get in and extract emails and hack into the RNC, and they had the protections in place. So, and the DNC didn't do a good enough job.
Yeah,
so, did I answer your question on that?
Yeah, you did. I actually made a joke about that, and I can't believe you just said it, that his password really was password?
Yes.
No, no, folks, don't do that. That's the oldest mess up in the book. Well, I just have to read something to you. Talk about losing the war.
Mm-hmm.
This is from ZeroHedge.com. Sweden's largest newspaper demands ban men in cars to stop terror. I'm serious about this. It was just a matter of time before we were forced to write this ridiculous post. You knew it was coming. We knew it was coming. And now the day has finally arrived that some extreme leftist has called for the banning of automobiles as a means of preventing terrorist attacks. You know, because the person driving the vehicle couldn't mm-hmm. possibly be to blame. Let's see. As per a translation from Breitbart London, Franchel's opinion piece referred to automobiles as effective murder machines that must be banned at once if our world leaders are truly committed to the cause of fighting terrorism. Instead, it is cars, which he calls effective murder machines, that Franchel says must be simply removed from city centers and places where people gather if people are to be protected in the future. Vehicles are easy to steal, and so nothing has been able to stop their advance. It isn't just reasonable that a big truck can be driven right into one of Stockholm's busiest streets on a Friday afternoon right before Easter. Yep. And here's the other part. Noting how it's a popular destination for tourists, Franchel says the city center must be a safe environment for visitors to enjoy. She described it as remarkable that it's possible to drive around the Swedish capital's medieval old towns. Outlining her vision for a car-free Stockholm, she argues, quote, most problems with regard to mobility and public transport can be solved, and deliveries to shops and restaurants could take place at times when people aren't out on the streets. Vehicles have been allowed to dominate our cities for decades, and it's the people who need space. It's vital now that cars be regulated. Oh, and here's the last one. Cars are driven largely by men. So by giving a lot of space to cars, we're giving a lot of space to men at the expense of women. That's Carolina Skog, S-K-O-G, explained. I mean, now, this complacency has turned into, first is the complacency, and then apparently the embrace of abject stupidity. Did you see this thing from a University of Wisconsin at Madison? Proper English is too difficult for minorities to learn, so Ebonics should not only be tolerated, but encouraged in the schools, which tells me that let's flip that around and put it another way. You're too stupid to learn. Therefore, we will accommodate your stupidity by allowing you to speak a made-up language that's less descriptive than Fonagalore, the language that all the miners, all the black miners from different tribes, when they went to work for the mines, they came up with their own language so they could talk to each other. And so now Ebonics is to be upheld. In other words, speaking English properly, proper English grammar, is now racist, Larry. Did you know this?
No, I didn't.
Well, now you do. I try to bring something to the party that's unexpected. So between that and, you know, vehicles they're driven largely by men, so we're giving men a lot of space at the expense of women. I mean, I don't understand how much more ridiculous things can be or get, and that civilization continue to function. I mean, this is like Orwell derivative stuff here. We're going to take out enough words out of the vocabulary that before long, those that would be used to, we won't be able to insult anybody or hurt anybody's feelings ever again because the words to do it will not exist. Now, they leave out the part about rolling your eyes or lifting, you know, just one of your fingers, you know, the middle one. Those have been known to incite violence and, you know, hurt people's feelings. So what are we going to do about that? Put mittens on everybody? I don't get it. I just don't. Help me out here, will you?
Orwell was correct. He saw into the future well. He just picked a number that was just a little early. This is 1984, but it's, you know, it's 2017. But yeah, what's going on the college campuses is thought control, of course, and it means that if you have conservative leanings, if you think that government should become smaller, as I do, you could be in a situation where if you were speaking at the University of California, Berkeley, for example, where you know, your life would be in jeopardy. You could, you know, the thought police have have populated large sections of the electorate now, and there, you know, a lot of people used to throw around the word fascists by referring to, you know, conservatives or people that, you know, a Trump voter as a fascist.
Yep.
But in fact, that's starting to die down because people have actually looked up, you know, in Wikipedia what it is means to be a fascist. And the thought police are very fascistic, as I'm sure you know. I'm sure your listeners know.
Well,
they're educated enough to understand what fascism means.
Well, that's the thing. They don't know what. It seems to me that this Orwellian thing is already taking root. They really don't understand what anything means. You just pick a phrase that kind of sounds good, doesn't really mean anything, but it kind of sounds good, such as the phrase, they hacked our election.
Mm-hmm.
And you just repeat that, and before long, the other morons, who apparently are bigger morons, begin nodding in agreement, even though they don't know what they're talking about. They remind me of a bunch of howler monkeys. One of them's bored and starts making noise, then before long, the whole tree full of them is doing it, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah, it is. I think it was Goebbels or somebody said, you know, a lie told often enough and long enough becomes true.
That's it. That's it. And, you know, it's funny, and I've said this many times, but you and I haven't had this conversation in which I said it, and that is there was an OSS report about this thing about Hitler's big lie theory. But, I mean, these people are following it to the letter. OSS did an analysis of his technique in reaching people. And it's mm-hmm. like, pick one target, stay on him continuously, never accept blame for anything, blame everything that goes wrong on this one target, repeat over and over again, never acknowledge that there's anything good in this person whatsoever, never even acknowledge them as a human being, so to speak. And these people have followed this protocol to the letter. It's unbelievable to me that the same stuff is working. Well, I don't remember who it was that said the biggest lesson of history is that people don't learn the lessons of history. And that's entirely correct. We just keep doing the same thing over and over again. Well, look, you know, you mentioned for Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, Volume 2, The Way Forward, to win any war is to know thy enemy. What is it about? Well, in your opinion, who is the enemy? And what is it that we should know about this enemy that apparently we do not?
Well, absolutely, definitely. It goes by different terms. I call it resurgent militant Islam. They are definitely an enemy of the West. Since 9/11, your listeners might be interested if they haven't gone and looked at it. There's a website, it's called the Religion of Peace. And I haven't looked at it recently, but the last time I looked, what they do is they catalog violent acts around the world by Muslims. And most of it, by the way, is Muslims attacking other Muslims. But nevertheless, they're just chronicling, and there was a counter there. And since 9/11, last time I looked, there were 25,000 attacks.
Was that all? Only 25,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then since 9/11, then, of course, we add in 9/11. And then what they don't catalog are all the plots that have been interrupted, prevented. So that's a fact. I mean, those are facts. You know, the facts get in the way sometimes for people who want to believe, that have a politically correct notion that because of the Crusades and the Inquisition and the Hundred Years' War, that Christianity is no different than Muslims. Muslims are no different than Christians, and therefore let's just move on and pretend there's nothing to see there. So that's the facts. Now they also have now allies in the North Koreans and the Chinese. Chinese are enablers. I think that in the case of China, they can be persuaded that maybe getting in bed with these people isn't the best way for China. But then you've got Putin, who's just an evil character, you know, and will side with anybody if it serves his purposes to reestablish the old Soviet Union. So what's happened in the last 8 years is that those alliances have now become very strong and allowed him to become strong. The idea that we can just become isolationists is, you know, the recipe for disaster. So to answer your question, the enemy is resurgent militant Islam. They claim that they're going to take over the West, that the black flag of Islam will fly over the nation's capital, and that we will eventually submit. And if it has to be done, you know, violently, so be it. That's fine. And you get into the Quran, and then the history of Muhammad himself. And there isn't any reason to think that this is not prescribed by the religion. Now, let me just say, and in the way forward, I think that the president, and maybe I'll get lucky, and my book will get into the Trump inner circle. There are people now, Islamic people, who are really actively talking about a Muslim reformation. And it's true that we did have an Inquisition, we the Christian West, but we have had a Reformation. And we are not responsible over the last period since 9/11 for 25,000 or so, probably up to 30,000 attacks. And who knows how many plots that have been interrupted. So there's just – we need to really face the facts and also encourage the Reformation. The movement is taking – I hinted at it in the book one, and I have a good section in book two. And the leader of it, by the way, is the head of Egypt, al-Sisi. Al-Sisi made a speech, and I have it in the book, to a group of their leading Islamic jurisprudence scholars, explaining that we, meaning the Muslim world, cannot have the entire world be against us, and that we must think in terms of he calls it a revolution. I'm calling it the second or the coming Muslim Reformation. That so much could be done if the President of the United States and other leaders started celebrating those people who are becoming apostates, or who are attempting to, and or who are attempting to reform the religion from within. So that's a hopeful sign. I mean, al-Sisi is running the largest Arab country in the world, so I dub him the leader of the Muslim Reformation movement.
Very interesting. You know, there's a thing about have you thought much about Turkey and Erdogan and his declaration that he's the leader of the Muslim world now? And he's going to be faced with a choice pretty soon about whether he's going to remain in NATO or whether he's going to become part of the caliphate. I mean, seriously, how can you declare yourself the leader of the Muslim world and not face that choice?
Yeah, I haven't studied Turkish politics thoroughly, but what I do know is that he has gone through a metamorphosis. He was much more Western leaning early in his dictatorship, and has now seems to be attempting to stir up anti-Western Islamist thinking and has, you know, become a an enemy of Israel, for example, and supporting, I don't know that he actively supports Hezbollah as in the way that Iran does, but he's definitely playing a double game. As somebody that's running a country that's in NATO, he's not a good ally. Let's put it that way. And so hopefully we have enough on our plate that he doesn't become a crisis flashpoint. I don't think he is yet, but we've got quite a few. The North Korean situation is just as you were talking about with the fellow sitting next to the other fellow, because we've also got Iran and the nuclear deal that was signed by Obama is just as much a sham as was Madeleine Albright's gift of the fuel they gave North Korea uranium-fueled reactors so that they could, you know, supposedly use the uranium for peaceful purposes. And essentially every agreement that that the North Koreans have signed, they've broken. Same way with Russia. And I'm sure, I'm absolutely 100% sure that the Iran deal's going to be exactly the same. That we're going to wake up one day and we're going to find out that they can launch intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Chinese are upset about North Korea. They really are. And, you know, anytime.
I hope so. I hope in a good way.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when the USS Carl Vinson shows up anywhere, mm-hmm. there's about to be a problem. It's I just wonder where this will go. But you know, you're talking about. I've heard that. I heard a little soundbite about China being worried about all these refugees spilling over the border. I'm pretty sure that they would love to get. Even going to China is a stretch, but I'm sure a lot of people would like to be able to get out of North Korea to get to China. And I'm thinking to myself, they've already got 2 billion people there. A couple hundred thousand more won't make any difference, you know, but maybe they just don't see it that way.
I don't know how many hundred thousands they fear would come over. I just don't know. And maybe, as I say, maybe the troops are there and they're going to move on them and take this guy out. That'd be awesome. So that we don't have to do it, and we don't have to risk, you know, our troops and, you know, 200,000, 300,000, you know, South Koreans. Because this guy, if he sees that he's going down, he meaning Kim Jong-un, I mean, we can be pretty rest assured he's going to just let loose with everything he's got, probably.
Yeah, he does seem to have that sort of mentality, doesn't he?
Yeah.
All right.
He's a real nut job.
Okay, I'm going to change gears again. I like the left lane for a while. Now let's go back over to the right lane. Let's just straddle the stripe, okay? You know, you were talking about the need for a reformation of Islam. And I keep thinking we were going to have a guy come on, but we didn't because it was too ridiculous and too stupid. So I just let it go. I just pulled it. Because his position was... There can't be a two-state solution. There needs to be a one-state solution in Israel where the Israelis show solidarity with the Palestinians. Well, I was riding in a car the other day. It was an Uber, as a matter of fact. I did not feel like attempting to drive into downtown Dallas at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so forget about it. And this guy was being very quiet, but he spoke, and I said, "Where are you from?" And he said... He said a sentence I can't even repeat now. I don't remember it because I was still waiting for the answer. And he said he's from Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got the destination. I said, "Listen, just a couple of strangers talking here. Can I ask you a couple of questions?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "How brutal is it being a Palestinian when Israel's right there? And you got your wall, and you got this, and you got that, and you got missiles coming this way, and you got IDF and going the other way." And he goes, "Well, the settlements were a problem." He goes, "Because We look at that as our land. They were building settlements. Now, that said, they've removed some of them, so it's okay. But the bottom line here, Larry, was that I said, we were going to talk to a guy who's just absolutely convinced that the Israelis need to show solidarity with the Palestinians, and we have a one-state solution, not a two-state solution. He goes, it's never going to happen. He goes, there will never be a one-state solution. That will not happen. And he said, the leadership is against it. And he just alluded to the fact that this is really tribal, and we're not going to mix it up. We need a two-state solution. As it stands now, Palestinians view Israel as occupying that land that they were on for a long time as just an invasion. He goes, that's just the way it is. We know about the holy sites. We get all of that. But they still look at it as an invasion. They took the land away from us by decree. So, fine. But we need to have a state of Palestine. That's just I said, where are you on this? He goes, I came to the United States. I'm over it. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him a little bit, but that's what he said. It's just too complicated. He goes, it's been going on forever. There will never be a one-state solution there. We are not going to live like this, you know, all in one place, and we're going to call it Israel. No, they're not going to go for this. It doesn't matter how long you work on it. I'm like, okay, now, going back to what you said about the need for a reformation of Islam, how's that going to work? I think are we coming up on like the 500-year anniversary of the Protestant movement, the separation from the Church of Rome and all that? I think we are.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's in that range, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like any day now if it hadn't already happened. But when you got Shias and Sunnis and Wahhabis and this one and that one, and they don't get they're really good at killing each other, what form would this reformation take, do you think?
One of them, to your point on Israel, one of them would, I would think, be the recognition of Israel. It's not 100%. I have quite a bit in the new book on the Kurds, and the Kurds are they're the largest ethnic minority without their own state. They occupy a diaspora that includes Turkey, parts of Turkey, Iraq, and even Iran, and Syria. Sorry. So and they have great respect for women, for example. That they are Islamic. They have all women fighting units. And in fact, I have pictures in the book too, and descriptions of them. And they also recognize Israel. They're in fact already a close ally of Israel. So, what I say we should do is, and I hope Trump does, is recognizes their right to the Kurds' right to you know, have a free independent homeland in northern Iraq, and that would also provide us with basing rights, which we need. We need to be in this neighborhood because leaving it without any military U.S. military presence is a disaster. And I think that if the Kurds, under our auspices, said, you know, the United States is going to recognize Kurdistan, and if they would come out and say, and we recognize Israel's right to exist, that should be part of the Reformation, because most of Islam doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. I mean, it's enmeshed in most state laws and their textbooks and their way of thinking. Another thing that should be part of that reformation is that the idea that an apostate should be killed. It's in the book. It's in the Muslim. It's in the Quran. Muhammad said, "He who leaves the religion, kill him." And so that's where they get the idea that if you become an apostate, they they may send, you know, your brother or your cousin or somebody. It's, you know, very, very much done on a vigilante-like basis for people who lead. Or another typical way, you heard about the honor killings. Another typical way that it happens is that a young Muslim girl doesn't want to be forced into a marriage that her father has arranged, decides to, you know, take up with a God forbid, a Christian, or maybe even a Jew, you know. Nobody that knows anything about Islamic jurisprudence disagrees with the prescription that apostasy is punishable by death in the religion as a core principle of it. So the right for Israel to exist and rules against apostasy must be part of the Reformation, in my view. Among other things.
Okay.
And yeah. I think it's possible. I think it's already starting, as a matter of fact.
And then what to do about this remaining really violent, murderous, crazy segment of the Islamic world, these nutcases. A lot of people say they're just mercenaries, but I don't know. They certainly, if they're just mercenaries, they certainly enjoy their work.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about absolutes and 100% and even in our lifetime kind of thing. It's a process, and you know, and as you pointed out, you know, we've gone through our Reformation and Enlightenment. And so I think that it can go quickly in this age of, you know, the internet and this ubiquitous communications that we have. It could be that it would take off with the right set of circumstances and obviously would take, you know, leadership from the ultimate bully pulpit, which is the presidency of the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I take
it. I'm going to give it my best shot, John.
I know you will. And as far as the winning agenda is concerned, I'm pretty sure that this Reformation is on the list. But, and I know, certainly I don't want you to reveal the whole list. That's why we want people to read the book, of course. But but can you give us a hint as to what some of the other things on the list might be?
During the Obama years, they came up with this notion. There's always been a notion of soft power and hard power. Hard power is where you use the threat of military force. Soft power refers to diplomacy and you know, giving stuff, giving a former adversary or somebody who's you're trying to convert from an adversary to an ally, favorable trade status and things like that. But during the past 8 years, they came up with this notion that was kind of an Obama doctrine that they were going to use smarter power, meaning Bush was dumb and we're going to be smarter. And it's failed. The soft power is only credible when I'm talking about when you're dealing with your adversaries here. You only have credibility, John, if the right set of circumstances happen, that adversary knows that you will use force. If he continues to threaten you with or your allies or your troops in the region with nuclear weapons, if you think that just being smarter and being cagier and be in your negotiations is going to work, it's already proven that it doesn't work. What works is when that adversary, let's say Kim Jong-un, who we're talking about, really believes that he may be looking at his last breakfast if he keeps going down that road. So that's one of the prescriptions. I'm not saying bomb the hell out of everybody, but I'm saying you have to have the kind of diplomacy where it is very well understood by your adversary that you will use force under some circumstances. So that's another one.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good stuff. I'll tell you, the things seem to be, you know, we were speaking before you came on. We were speaking with Tonson Fairmont, and he was saying that there appears to be some external pressure being applied from the spiritual realm, if we wanted to call it that, or you know, God, or or however. I mean, he was trying to phrase it in a way wouldn't offend anybody or put anybody off. But it really looks like, despite the really, really concerted efforts of the ones on the left, the forces of destruction like this this ISIS bunch, this lying news media, if I may just be blunt, the propaganda purveyors.
You didn't offend me by saying that.
I mean, I've never seen anything like it. This is like sub-juvenile all the way to malicious, moronic behavior, really is. But you know what? I'm seeing those apparati not being dismantled. Well, yeah, but they're dismantling themselves. It's almost as though they have really run their string out, and now they're standing there, and they're holding nothing except their culpability and responsibility for causing all these problems with no measurable result other than isolated incidences of tragedy which they perpetrated. And they are losing support. All of those things that I mentioned, they're all losing support. I mean, even down to that doctor, he had his seat on the airline. It was a voluntary give up your seat. And these moronic thugs drag this man, a dignified, productive individual, you know, a legitimate member of a functioning society. They drag him off like some rowdy drunk in one of the worst bars you could ever hope to never find yourself in. And you know what? They've lost $1 billion in value, stock-wise, and he's also hired a real high-powered attorney. You cannot continue to treat people like that. And I really think that all of this nonsense is about to be recognized for what it is. And in the same way that a joke, I use this analogy all the time, in the same way that a joke suddenly is known by everybody in the country. You don't even know how it happened, but everybody's wise to it. It seems like it happens on Wednesday or whatever, you know. I think everybody's getting wise to the fact that so much has been going wrong for so long that we're over it, which is why at the beginning of the year I declared 2017 to be the year of intolerance. Not that we're not going to tolerate this group or that group. Then it wasn't bigotry. It's the nonsense that we're not going to tolerate anymore. This stuff has had its day, and it's now over with, and we're not going to tolerate it anymore. We're just not. We're not going to buy the products if that's what it takes. We're not going to participate in the conversations if that's what it takes. And we're not going to attend their lectures or their university or colleges if that's what it takes. And maybe once these people start going a little bit broke, maybe they'll figure out that the deck is stacked totally against them, and they need to shift. They need to shift their position. They need to abandon their position because it's just not working for them. They're not going to get their way. Do you see this at all?
I was reading someplace. With respect to the fake media, left wing media that is losing its clout. I think that their biggest fear that these people have, and I'm talking about the also people like Chuck Schumer and so on, and Congress. I think their biggest fear, John, is that Trump is going to be a good president, that he's going to do things well. Certain things are going to happen. I mean, look at the stock market already. So when you say that you think we're going to not tolerate this anymore, I think that's occurring. I think their audience is really fixed, and that they really are continuing to lose audience and advertisers. And so I think that's just going to be happening because, one, people are disgusted with them, and two, market forces are such that if I never buy a New York Times, then you know, at some point they're gonna run out of money. I read one place, this was funny, the New York Times bought the Boston Globe and, you know, merged it. And the price for the Boston Globe was the value of the building that they were. I guess they owned the building.
Is that a fact?
So, yeah. So the cost to buy the Boston Globe was the price of the real estate. The goodwill was valued at nothing.
That's amazing. Wow, that didn't make
me back. Yeah, but
that didn't make mainstream.
I think the news media might just have to correct itself, given the fact that they can't keep going in the way they're going now, but in continuing to lose market share. But I don't know how the universities get fixed. With this the other day, I mean, they have gone down that road, so far down that road, and they are so insular. They so believe in political correctness, that political correctness is correct, and that everybody else is wrong, and they are right. But even so, I think market forces may enter into that picture too, because online education. What if people realize that, you know, if you go to Yale, it costs you $100,000 a year, as opposed to being able to, have a student go online and get an engineering degree through his own ingenuity. My youngest son has taught himself how to program and is, working in a high tech capacity, but based on very little what he'd learned in college, he's just acquired it on his own. Through the internet, through online sites. And so that could happen too. You know, I mean, and it would also be, in my view, driven by employers. Can you imagine if you're an employer, you got two kids coming in and they want to start out as an entry level, you know, engineering position of some sort. And one kid, yeah, his parents sent him to a college that costs, you know, $75,000 a year. And the other kid got his engineering degree online for a tiny fraction of that,
yeah,
and financed it himself. I mean, which would be the more attractive candidate, you know?
Wow. Well,
so that could happen too.
You know, that's a really good point on the online thing. I think of all the beer busts that person would have missed.
Still go down to the local pub, you know, but anyway. yeah, there aren't as many girls around. That's the problem.
Well, we can get your book either through Amazon or directly from your site. I'm thinking we should get it directly from your site, lessonsfromfallencivilizations.com. Why not give all the money to the author? You did the work. Just cut those Amazon mugs out of this, okay?
that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
It's very easy to find. It's LarryKelly.com, KELLEY.com. I had a guy by the same name write me. He said he was a dentist in Kentucky or something. And he said, oh, you know, I see you've got the LarryKelly.com. Would you be willing to sell that? And I said, well, I really wasn't thinking of selling that, you know, domain name, but why don't you make me an offer? So he comes back to me and offers me $500, and I just laughed.
Ridiculous. $500. Wait a minute. What is that in 80s money? No, I'm not taking it. Yeah. It's always good talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
I don't think we left any gold on the table, but with you, it's hard to tell. I'm pretty sure there's some gold that we left on this table, but we'll pick it up next time. All right. And I'll guarantee you it won't be 500 episodes until we talk again. How about that?
All right. I'd love to do it anytime, John. Anytime.
Thank you very much for what you do and for being in the fight. It's a good fight, and it's a righteous fight. It's good to be next to you, shoulder to shoulder. We'll win.
Thank
it
you.
May take a while, but we'll make it.
Yeah. All thanks, right. John.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, is that something or is that something? Oh. You know, and going to the point about these things straightening up, all this ugliness about the current presidential family, starting with the first lady here. Forget Mr. Trump, you know. He's a tough guy. He can take it. He just gives as good as he gets, you know, and more. China's told North Korea, Donald Trump's not bluffing. You better pay attention. You're about to get a slap. And I think they are. But anyway, let's talk about the First Lady for a minute. The elegant, beautiful, educated, stately, statuesque, dignified First Lady, as opposed to the football player in the dress that we had. Now get this. This is from Sky.com, news.sky.com. Melania Trump accepts damages from Daily Mail over model claims. I don't know if you ever heard this one, but get this. An article published in the newspaper, quote, included false and defamatory claims, end quote, about her work as a model. The High Court hears. By Adele Robinson, news correspondent, and Alan McGinnis, news reporter. The action was against Associated Newspapers, publishers of the Daily Mail, after it ran an article headlined, Racy Photos and Troubling Questions About His Wife's Past That Could Derail Trump. You incipient little prigs. Also prats. Maybe even, well... The amount of damages was not disclosed in court, although Sky News understands the total payment of damages and costs is believed to come to less than 2.4 million pounds, or about 3 million bucks. In an article published in the newspaper and on Mail Online last August, false and defamatory claims about the First Lady, which questioned the nature of her work as a professional model, and republished allegations that she provided services beyond simply modeling, the court heard. The piece referred to rumors that a modeling agency Mrs. Trump worked for in Milan was, quote, something of a gentleman's club, end quote. And another in New York, quote, operated as an escort agency for wealthy clients, end quote. Her lawyer, John Kelly, said the story included statements that Mrs. Trump denied the allegations and that Paolo Zampoli, who ran the modeling agency, also denied the claims. The article, he said, stated, in addition, there was no evidence to support the allegations. Mr. Kelly told Mr. Justice Nickel, the article also claimed that Mr. and Mrs. Trump may have met 3 years before they actually met and staged their actual meeting as a ruse. He said the allegations about Mrs. Trump were not true and strike at the heart of the claimant's personal integrity and dignity. Katrin Evans, QC for the publishers, told the judge, the defendant acknowledges that these claims about the claimant are untrue and we retract and withdraw them. The defendant is here today publicly to set the record straight and to apologize to the claimant for any distress and embarrassment that the articles may have caused her. In its apology, the Daily Mail said it accepts the allegations about Mrs. Trump, quote, are not true, and we retract and withdraw them. It added, we apologize to Mrs. Trump for any distress that our publication caused her. And that is that. So Mika, and who's the guy over at MSNBC? Rachel? Bite it. Bite it hard, and keep biting it. Like a horse biting a bit. That way, your mouths will remain shut, which I think is a really, really good idea. Okay? All right. A rockin' episode, to be sure. And a rockin' rest of the week. And I look forward to speaking with you again on Ock Midnight on Saturday night. That's going to be a rockin' show as well. Okay? Between now and tomorrow night, as always, exercise caution in your daily affairs. Keep those eyes up always. Prepare for renaissance as we make ready for what's to come. Be seeing you. God bless.